Welcome to Scrappy ABM, your source for groundbreaking approaches that don't break the bank. ABM shouldn't cost $200K in tech to even get started. So if you want to get started with ABM or make your program even better without investing a massive amount of money, you're in the right place. Each week, we'll hear from the brightest minds in the marketing world who are redefining ABM, achieving incredible results with untraditional methods, limited resources, and a whole lot of creativity. This isn't a show about how much money you can spend on fancy tech or overhyped tools. Instead, it's about celebrating creative problem solving and the scrappiness it takes to get ABM right. We'll dive into how these marketing leaders built robust ABM strategies with limited resources, revealing the actionable insights that led to their biggest wins. So if you're a marketer ready to challenge the status quo and build a scalable, efficient, effective marketing strategy, Scrappy ABM is the show for you. So if you're ready to discover ABM strategies that are lean, impactful, and utterly transformative, let's dive into this episode.
Today on this show, we have Mason Cosby from Scrappy ABM joining us today. Very excited to have Mason. Been following him on LinkedIn for a bit. He has a lot of great stuff to share. And he was just at B2B MX last week as well, where he was sharing a lot of great tips on how companies can start thinking about an ABM motion that doesn't have to cost a lot. Mason, happy to have you on the show.
Yeah, well, Parthi, thank you again for having me. Always excited to hop on a podcast and chat marketing. So I'm founder of Scrappy ABM, like you mentioned, and Scrappy ABM is the only ABM service provider that provides step-by-step programs for the crawl stage of account-based marketing. So again, like you had mentioned, I was at B2B MX last week talking through how do you get started? Again, everybody talks about the crawl, walk, run approach. As we started to build Scrappy ABM, we recognize that there's this little niche of kind of this early stage of building an ABM program. There wasn't a dedicated service provider to actually helping somebody get something off the ground. So again, we really try to own that niche. We've worked with about 25 clients in the past 6 months, and we've helped a lot of clients get off the ground. So that's who we are. That's what we do. And again, I have the fortunate title of founder because I was the guy that said we should do it and brought in people way smarter than me to help me get it done. So that's a little bit about me and what we're doing.
Amazing. That's quite a lot of clients for 6 months of work. So congrats on that.
You're telling me.
One thing I noticed about you, Mason, when I was going through your LinkedIn, that you actually have a sales background, right? So you made the transition from sales to marketing before starting Scrappy ABM. There aren't a lot of marketers who have that. So would love to understand from your perspective, what did you learn from being on the other side, on the sales side, that you wish every marketer, at least B2B marketer, knew?
Yeah. And before we dig into that, I do want to clarify before a bunch of marketers come after me with pitchforks, I'm like, wait, you're a seller? My entire career, I've straddled the two. I don't know why. I don't know how. But like my first job was a full funnel AE at an advertising company. So I sold marketing and then I transitioned to being the marketing director at a fintech company. So then I marketed financial technology and then I transitioned to being the marketing person at an agency. So I marketed marketing to marketers and then I became the salesperson at that agency. So I sold marketing to marketers and then I transitioned to a sales education company doing marketing for sales education to sellers. And now I'm building my own business. So like this entire career, other than like the weird stint in a fintech company, has only ever been like selling marketing or marketing or selling sales or selling it's a whole weird thing. So I just wanted to clarify that real quick because it's been back and forth the entire career. And again, I think the thing, and it's crazy that this is a lesson that I learned very immediately in my career, because that first job, I was a full funnel AE. So cradle to grave, no marketing support. I managed the account. So I didn't know the terminology around like account management or customer success. I just thought like this was my job. So I actually think it's less of what do I wish marketers understood about sellers? And I wish it's more of like what I wish every part of the three revenue teams of marketing, sales, and CS understood about the other roles. Is the importance of each individual role within the larger context of actually an account-based marketing program. Because when we think about ABM, I don't think it's a marketing and sales. I think it's actually marketing, sales, and CS. Oh, and by the way, ideally also your finance team that's actually factoring in client profitability. So as we're looking at who are our best fit customers, it's not just who are the easy ones to close, but it's who has the longest retention rate, that is easy to work with for our CS teams, and as a result, who have the highest client profitability, so we can understand as we go on the front end, because marketing's job is to bring these people to sales. So if we think about it from a who's going to stay around for a really long time and is highly profitable and gets a ton of value out of working with us, those people we should really be going after. So again, if there's anything that I wish marketers knew from sellers and CS and finance, it's understanding the nuances of what each team will be looking for in their part of the organization, of the whole holistic revenue funnel, and valuing that and understanding it so that then they can better attract the right fit customers on the front end.
Absolutely. And if you think about it from the customer's perspective or from your buyer's perspective, all of this is just a continuum from hearing about you to actually going through the process of purchasing you to actually using your product and seeing success and telling their boss, like, hey, I want to renew this product that we purchased. And so they don't really care about your marketing team or your sales team or your CS team. And I think in a buyer-centric world, we should really think about, okay, how do we make sure that we're thinking about long-term success with these customers as opposed to how do I do my part of the job, toss a bunch of MQLs or like whatever outdated terminology you want to use, leads over to sales, sales closes whatever's easiest, tosses over to CS, and then you have a very, very inefficient revenue engine. Along those lines, one of the things that I've just observed in running a MarTech company from many of our customers is how sales and marketing at a lot of companies don't play well together. There's a lot of finger pointing. There's a lot of sales saying like, hey, you sent over bad leads, or marketing being like, hey, like actually it's your close rate or what's going on here. So give me the crawl, walk, run. When you start talking to companies, how do you really help them think about getting sales and marketing rowing in the same direction?
Yeah. So, I mean, real quick, we had a cut. So sorry, editing team on the back end. There was a cut out for a second. So I think the question was, again, marketing and sales, they don't align. How do we get marketing and sales rowing in the same direction?
Yes, correct.
Cool. I think that's something that's being talked about more frequently as we look at marketing and sales team alignment, but it's largely actually not the fault of the operators in the day-to-day of marketing and sales. It's largely actually looking at the compensation structure specifically for your sellers, because a lot of sellers are directly, like half of their compensation is directly tied to what deals did they close. The other interesting thing is how you incentivize different sellers to cooperate. So we're working with a client and their greatest opportunity for net new revenue is actually an expansion motion, but their internal sales team is not compensated unless it's the designated product line that they are selling. So there's no referral commissions to other sellers. There's no kind of ownership of an actual account. It's just, I own this account with this product line. And as long as this account continues by this product line, I will make more and more money. But if I involve other product lines, that may steal some from my budget. So I'm going to actually lose money, even if the company overall makes more money. So again, in that context, that's not like even marketing and sales alignment. That's like sales to sales alignment. So if you look at the compensation structure, the goal of a compensation structure is to incentivize right actions from your teams so that they will help you grow the company. So again, when you look at how a seller is compensated, it's directly the actions that they will take. So if they are compensated directly on specific activities, then they are more likely to work well together with marketing. The flip side of that is marketing needs to understand how sales is incentivized. So again, if you send over 200 leads and say, I need you to contact all of these leads today, and then you send another batch of 200 leads the next day, and another batch of 200 leads the next day, and they convert at 0.1%, of course, they're not going to action them. But if you send over 20 leads or 20 accounts that are highly engaged and they convert at 5%, maybe, much more likely to be actioned. So again, if you think about it, how many are we passing over? What is the time investment that's going to be required from our sellers? Because in their context, especially if half of their compensation is tied up in directly commissions, their time is literally their money. So the more that you can ensure that they're wisely using their time versus just sending over a volume and saying, I hope it pans out, the more likely they are to actually work with you. So those are the two things. Again, at a leadership level, have you created a compensation structure that actually incentivizes marketing and sales to work well? Or even more than that, have you created a compensation structure that allows your sellers as individuals to work well on a team, regardless of sales and marketing alignment? Like, just in general, can they work well on a team with their current compensation structure? First thing. Second thing, once that's done marketing, can you understand how sales is incentivized and actually create programming that helps them tangibly and directly reach how they are incentivized from a compensation perspective? Because if you can put more dollars in your sellers' pockets, of course they're going to work with you. Sellers are largely money motivated. Makes sense. They're in sales. Like, it's not to be rude or mean. I am largely money motivated. I'm a business owner. My job is to increase my profits so I can hire more people and help more people. Like, that's it. So if you want to know how to help me out, help me figure out how I'm going to make more money so I can continue to run my organization. So anyway, that's my soapbox around money motivation and incentives and how to align better with marketing and sales.
Follow-up question on that. So we talked about marketing, understand how sales is incentivized. How do you align, how do you get marketing to be incentivized to do that? Because the vast majority of marketers I talk to are still in this paradigm of, I need to just hit some sort of like lead goal. They would prefer to send over those 200 as opposed to those 20, like highly engaged, like more likely to be qualified.
Yeah. And this is where it gets into a bit of a struggle. Personally, I don't have a qualm as a marketer actually being aligned on a revenue goal. As long as my sellers are on the same revenue goal. So like, we win together, we lose together. I love that mentality. The challenge with that is I have way less control over how a seller sells. So I think, because I actually worked in an organization in which we tried that, but the seller's conversion rates were 8%. And I was like, we need to close 100 deals this year. That's what you're telling me. We need to have 100 new customers, which means I need to generate 1,000 opportunities in a B2B context for our seller to hit the 100. There's something broken with our sales process, and they wouldn't let me fix the sales process. So like, I have that's where there's some of the challenges around alignment on revenue. Because again, if you have an 8% conversion rate from discovery to closed one, there's something fundamentally wrong with the process or product market fit. Because no matter how many accounts you generate, like, it's just it's a waste of time. So again, if you have a sustainable, effective sales process where you're at least closing 20% of your accounts, ideally you're closing closer to like 30, which some people think I'm crazy for that, but like, I close at 45%. So like, if you have a 30% close rate from intro call to actual close one, align on revenue, because then you actually have sustainable conversion metrics where the number of accounts you'd need to generate is a reasonable number. If you don't, one, beat the drum on it and try to fix it. If that doesn't work, two, ideally you're actually aligned on a number of discovery calls that are booked with ICP FETs. So sales accepted accounts. So again, in that context, and I don't think it truly aligns longer term, but if you have to, if you can get it to a point where the sales has said, this is a great fit account, I'd like to work with this account, and I'll work them through the deal, through the process. Sales accepted accounts is a metric that marketing can align on with sales, because sales has said, I will take ownership from this point forward and I will own the results. And marketing has said, anything before this, I own the results. So there's a clear delineation of responsibilities. Again, do I think that creates the best alignment longer term? No, because a sales accepted account is from my perspective, it's a lagging metric from a marketing perspective, but it's a leading metric from a revenue perspective. So it's still not the end goal, but it's helpful along the way. So it's kind of a non-answer, from being honest, but I know a lot of marketers don't want to align on revenue because they don't trust their sales team, which is kind of why we need to align marketing and sales in the first place.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, I think sales accepted and revenue, assuming you have a good sales process, are both good numbers. And yes, I think I think this is also like why you're seeing like more companies having like CROs start to become in vogue, where people are starting to look across the revenue journey from marketing to sales to CS to kind of bridge these gaps where the silos are forming and people are seeing hiccups. Let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk a little bit more directly about ABM. So historically, when I've ever had a conversation with a company that claims they're running an ABM strategy, what they really mean is I've created a list in Sales Nav of a couple hundred, maybe accounts or 1,000 accounts. And then for each one of those, we've found a handful of people or stakeholders that we want to go after. And at that point in time, we just spam them with cold email from our BDR SDR team and hit them with a ton of display ads. We upload this into LinkedIn or tool of choice with targeting and then pump these companies with ads. And then maybe they'll be a little bit, they'll think a little bit about retargeting and maybe de-anonymize people on their website, think a little bit about intent, but really not really act on that. In your mind, what is an actual good ABM program and why do most ABM programs look like this?
Yeah. So for starters, when we think about how to structure an ABM program, what a good ABM program looks like, generally speaking, there are four key components of an ABM program. So we think about data, so who we're going after, and additionally, past data, because a lot of these SalesNav or people that are using data enrichment platforms, they're focused on the firmographics. So like, what's the revenue amount? What are the number of employees? What's the right industry? So they're thinking technically from a data perspective, but the piece that they're missing from a data perspective is like, what's our trigger? Like, what? Why are we reaching out to any of these people? What is the reason to reach out? I think about that a lot as I look at working with sales teams, because again, if you can pass an account and say, we're passing this account over for these very tangible reasons. And it's not, they hit a specific lead score or an account score. It's, these are the actual reasons. Like they hit our product page, our pricing page, and our schedule a call page, and they didn't book a call. You should probably reach out. Like, of course the seller's going to activate on that. So data, trigger, and then the other component is based on that data set, how should that inform our content? So again, who are we going after? And based on that filtering criteria, how do we speak directly to that audience? Those are the first three things as we think about data. I don't think even most of those, most people are not even thinking past the first one, which is like, who are we going after? And again, they go with the biggest, broadest list they can and call it account-based marketing. So that's the first piece. Second piece is distribution. So this is largely what you referenced earlier of like, could be display ads, could be cold outbound email. But again, like really map out what are the distribution channels that we have to get access to this audience. If we really break it down to more of a first principle thinking, it's just how do we get in front of these people? Some of my best ABM programs were community plays. I figured out where my accounts were hanging out from an online community perspective. I just hung out in those communities and I answered their questions and I was present and I was active. And as a result, I distributed my information in those communities in a way in which they received the information appropriately. So it's breaking it down of how do we distribute information to this data source? Third, destination. What are we pointing people to? Is it a case study? Is it a piece of blog content? Is it a podcast? Is it a webinar series? Is it a dedicated offer page? Like there's a thousand different things you can point people to, but you've got to point people somewhere so that they can actually engage with your brand. So what's the destination? And then lastly, direction. How are we tracking if they are coming closer to becoming in our account or further away? A lot of people will hear me as I say that and say like, oh, form fills, we're doing lead gen. Not necessarily. Like, again, if you have a designated landing page that you only promote through one designated channel to one designated audience, and you see traffic on that page, and you can de-anonymize your account level traffic with a tool called Warmly for free, if these accounts have never shown up on your website, and then you see these accounts that are only, again, it's only distributed through like one or two channels because it's a part of this campaign, you see those accounts showing up on that landing page, you are tracking. These people are engaging, and they have a higher level of engagement than those that did not hit this page. That is direction. You can also look at like an individual HubSpot CTA. You can create a designated single CTA that's put on a single page and you can actually see the number of clicks on that CTA. And that is a directional tracking metric. So again, those are some things that you can think through. And once you've understood and answered those four questions, again, data, who are going after, distribution, what are the channels that we're using, destination, what are you pointing people to, direction, how are we tracking it? You answer those four questions, in a way that is logical, you can actually build any kind of an ABM program. I think the reason that most ABM programs look like they do today is because, admittedly, when ABM platforms came on the scene, they were really, really over-glamorized account-based advertising platforms. So that's where most people think ABM is just like, we can advertise to our accounts wherever they are, and like we can follow them all over the internet. And like, it was a tactic that became viewed as the strategy. So that's why I think it exists that way today. ABM platforms in a lot of ways have matured, but I still think that ABM is still largely dictated by tech vendors. It's the only strategy that I've still heard to this day somebody say, I want to buy ABM. I still have people come inbound to me and they're like, we're excited to buy a tech platform that will enable us to do ABM. Like, I'm a vendor in like a services space. I'm an agency. They're like, wait, you mean ABM has service? Like, you're an ABM agency? That's a thing? You don't have that with inbound. You don't have to have that with content. So again, that's why I think ABM programs are still built the way that they are. And hopefully a better way forward is that 4D framework that we just walked through.
Gotcha. One of the things I liked about the way you talk about it, ABM, is like, once again, thinking about it from first principles. And you mentioned direction as your third point there. We need to be able to point people to somewhere. One thing I noticed about yourself is you're very active on LinkedIn with over 18,000 followers. And you also have a podcast, which has over 40 episodes. Tell me a little bit more about the role of your LinkedIn content, your podcast content, in terms of your own business and how you encourage your customers to start thinking about, or your clients to start thinking about this as well, and how content fits into an ABM program in that direction component.
Great question. From the super highest level, I'm going to walk through actually all 4Ds on LinkedIn. So like, I have 18,000 followers on LinkedIn, but for the past 3 or 4 years, I've been directly connecting with ICP fit target accounts. So the vast majority of my audience is actually the data set that I was intentionally pursuing. You can connect with up to 100 people on a weekly basis every single week for a few years. You build a large audience. Like, I wish it were more complicated than that, but it's just the intentionality of who do I connect with that then becomes a part of my network. So that's the data set. Distribution is actually the content that I post through LinkedIn. So I very actively share things from the podcast, things from presentations that I share, things from interviews like this, things from some of our playbooks that we're developing. I share a lot on LinkedIn as a distribution mechanism. The destination piece is then, where do I point somebody to? So again, sometimes it's just like, hey, if you like this content, follow me on LinkedIn. I'm a half decent follow sometimes. Like, I'm okay if the goal for some of my content is to get people to engage more with my content. I have other pieces of content in which I post a podcast clip and I point people towards the podcast, and I can track that. I've actually got some tools on my side. I did a great deal with a company called Kasten. So if somebody is existing in my CRM, I can actually see the number of episodes and downloads that they've done on individual podcast episodes. So I actually have podcast attribution using a tool called Kasten. And as long as they're in my CRM, I can actually track that. So again, there's actually directional tracking on people that have been to my show that are part of the people that I'm trying to work with. There's also then a newsletter component. So I have a newsletter that is the podcast newsletter. And I have over 1,000 subscribers on that after just a couple of months of promoting that. So again, I can track who's actually opening and clicking and engaging in that podcast newsletter. And then lastly, I do have my one-page website still. I'm in the process of adding more pages to it, but I can see the days that I have spikes and I can see what accounts are hitting the website. And as long as, again, everything for me was built on HubSpot. So if I have that contact in my existing CRM, which I have used some other tools to actually export my entire LinkedIn following into my CRM. They're not marketing contacts, but I can track them based on their engagement with my website and my podcast. I can see who is engaging with the website and actually potentially follow up one-to-one in that way. So again, from a directional perspective, largely it's focused on getting data into your existing CRM, which then becomes your first party data, and using your first party data to track engagement overall.
Absolutely. And I think that's the part, to your point earlier, I think that's the part a lot of companies are missing out in terms of understanding the value of the value of giving the people you're reaching out to a reason to engage with you, right? Mm-hmm. If you're just in the mode of buy from me, a lot of your outbound, a lot of your display ads are fairly transactional. You're not giving people a lot of opportunity to actually want to engage with you or learn from you in any capacity, which makes it a much harder conversation to even directionally start gathering that intent in the first place. And I do think content fills a great role in that across platforms, to your point, newsletter, podcast, website, LinkedIn, etc. Speaking of podcasts, I noticed that one of your service offerings is literally like helping companies get podcasts off the ground, industry podcasts off the ground. Tell me a little bit more about why you think companies running ABM programs should do a podcast, and what's stopping more companies from doing it?
Two core reasons. So again, as we think about this 4D framework, one of the core pillars is destination. So like, what are you pointing people to? And so many people struggle with creating that new content. They find themselves struggling to write. They find themselves struggling to be on camera. They find themselves like, there's a thousand reasons that they struggle with content. And what I personally love about podcasting is your first 13 episodes are probably going to be terrible. And I mean that with all kindness. If you want to go listen to my first podcast, it's called The Marketing Ladder. First 13 episodes were awful. Like, I just was horrible as a host. It's horrible as a guest. And I had to do quite a few guesting opportunities to get half decent at being a guest. But once you've done it and you've kind of gotten over the hump and you get used to seeing yourself, and it's actually easier now that we've been largely living in a remote world, you're kind of used to seeing yourself on a camera now. So once you've gotten over that hump, you can then just create a ton of content relatively easily through podcasting. Because if we think about how do we create written content, we generally interview a subject matter expert on a specific topic. Sounds like a podcast. So we take the interview, and then depending on how structured you want to actually be with the content, you could actually do keyword research on the front end and structure the questions that you ask to align with H2 headings or H3 headings. And then you actually just ask questions that then become the outline of your podcast. You just literally copy and paste over the transcript. You clean up the transcript a little bit, which you could actually probably do largely through, not probably, you can do it largely through ChatGPT. You could literally just feed it a section and say, like, can you reformat this as a blog? Takes you about 15, 20 minutes to get it through ChatGPT that way, which again, for free. And then you've got a blog that's 70% of the way there. So again, it's something that as a podcast, if you create and if you use it appropriately, it becomes video content, becomes long form video, short form, long form. Social content that can be posted pretty easily in, again, a short form way. It becomes long form blog content, and you get a podcast. You can turn it into a newsletter. My podcast is largely a newsletter. So it becomes, if you're familiar with the hub and spoke model, it becomes the hub that then fills in all the rest of your content pieces. So one, from a content perspective and actually filling up your content inventory relatively quickly. That's why I like podcasting. The second thing is relationship components. So this came from a book called Content-Based Networking. There's a guy named James Carberry, and he runs the agency Sweetfish. James ran a podcast and was trying to get guests on the show, and he recognized, you know, he was trying to sell his stuff. Oh, like 8 out of 10 people say yes to joining a podcast. But if I try to just do cold outbound, I'm lucky if I get a 5% conversion rate. So again, with podcasting, and there's some nuance to this. Like, you need to ask people that are at a similar level to you. And forgive me for being so blunt, but like, I'm probably not going to get Alex Hormozi on my podcast. He is exponentially at a higher level than I am. But I could probably get somebody like Chris Walker. I've gotten Chris Walker on my podcast. He is at a higher level, but not like so high up that he's unattainable. And also we're same industry. So again, there are those. He would be a reach guest in my opinion. But still, you can interview people, and the likelihood that they say yes is generally speaking about 80%. Now, how this turns into account-based play is you just invite your target accounts onto a show. So again, let's say I wanted to break into a specific account, and I'm just doing this outreach all over and over and over again. Ballpark, if I'm just doing cold outreach, I'm going to get in the ballpark of a 3 to 5% conversion rate. If I really crush it and I'm super nuanced and I have a great trigger, I could get a 10% conversion rate from a prospecting perspective. Whereas if I really just want to build a relationship, I can ask just about anybody onto a show with an 80% confidence level, they'll say yes. And especially, and forgive me for saying it this bluntly, but like for someone like me, that's been very active on social in my industry, very publicly for 3 or 4 years at this point, the likelihood that somebody says yes to me is pretty high. not because I've been around long enough and people know that I exist generally, maybe they're familiar, but the likelihood that somebody says yes to me is pretty solidly yes. So again, from a new business development perspective, if you got to think through how do I best use my time, the opportunity to get a guaranteed yes with the right fit buyer to talk about the problems that they're experiencing through the podcast that you're interviewing them on and to build just a great relationship is one of the best ways to do it. And then the likelihood that they hop on a call with you later is exponentially greater because you've provided and actually led with value, which value is a bit of a loose word for most people. But if you invite someone on, you promote them, you let them share their expertise, that is leading with value. They will be more likely to actually hop on a call with you after because you build a relationship led with value versus, hey, here's a cold pitch.
Absolutely. And quite honestly, we just started our podcast. We're probably like 8 episodes in. And this is quite literally the playbook. This interview started as a blog post and we're like, I want an expert to actually contribute to this blog post. Like, who's out there who knows ABM really well? And like, lo and behold, like you pop up on LinkedIn a ton for ABM and here we are. So can confirm that it definitely works. People are exponentially more likely to want to talk about themselves, talk about like what they care about, than just have somebody kind of like pitch slap them on LinkedIn. And they're just like, yeah, you and 100 other vendors who reached out to me this morning.
Yep.
Very last thing. So we've created all this content. We've talked about direction. We've directed people to all of these assets. Let's talk a little bit about intent. I think there's lots of ways in which people collect intent. There's also first party intent data. There's third party intent data. Like you have the Bamboras and stuff of the world. I think right now, a lot of people are sort of a little bit sour about third party intent data for good reason. I'm just curious as to like in your perspective, like what is actually valuable intent data? What are the signals you truly look for? And what are the signals where you're like, yeah, like this is as good as noise?
Again, it really depends on your organization, your industry, and then how you marry that up with something. So from my perspective, nothing will beat first party data, just impossible to beat. Because again, if I can see that a right fit customer is on my product page, they're looking at my pricing page and they're looking at my schedule a call page and they keep coming back, like that's a hard one to beat. And then if you marry that up with third party intent data and you're seeing, okay, they're not just like looking at our website, but they're actually looking at the category as a whole. Again, you marry those two up together. There's a very clear, they're very clearly in a buying cycle. So from my perspective, first party is preferred. Third party is directional. And when I say that, you know, we've got a client that has been using G2 intent data and they're like, we've actually not gotten a deal out of this because G2 intent data is largely directional. So they see an organization, and let me be very clear, I don't know the person, they know an organization that could be anywhere from 100 to 10,000 people. Someone in that organization started looking for their category, maybe did a product comparison, but I don't know who it is. I don't know how serious they are as a buyer. And they don't really even know who to reach, like, again, because they don't know who it is, they don't know who to reach out to. So I look at that as, and they've even framed it to me this way of like, it helps us kind of because all of prospecting is largely a needle in a haystack type approach. At least we now know there's a haystack and there's a needle in that haystack. So now the question becomes like, how do we find that needle in the haystack? So from my perspective, if you're going to use third-party intent data, ideally it's married up with first-party engagement data. And your third-party intent data is not a cold pitch. It's a content-led outbound of, hey, it looks like you're searching potentially for something like this. Here's some additional educational information that will help you make an informed purchase decision. And it's not intended to close right on that. It's intended to inform so that you can drive them towards first-party engagement. And then if you can see that they're engaging on your website, and then again, they're looking at your product pages, then you can follow up one-to-one based on, hey, it looks like you were looking at G2 search results, and then you also checked out some of our products. Based on what you were searching for, this is why we would be the best option. And based on the research that I did, I think this is probably what you're looking for. If I'm off base, please let me know. Cause and let me reframe that. Cause it's not, hey, here's a feature dump. But I like to think about for any company, like what's your onlyness statement? So like, who are you the only people in the category that do a specific thing? If you think back to the beginning of this episode, I frame Scrappy ABM up as we are the only ABM service provider that delivers step-by-step programs for the crawl stage of account-based marketing. By the way that I framed our organization, you have three options if you're looking at getting ABM off the ground. You work with us, you do it internally, you don't do it. Yes, you could go to a different ABM vendor, but like nobody else specializes in the crawl stage. Nobody else specializes in getting you off the ground as their sole thing. We're the only people. So again, if you can figure out what your onlyness is, then you frame that up and say, hey, looks like you were surging on G2 intent data, plus you were looking at some of our product pages. If X thing is really important to you, we are the only organization in this category that do X thing. If that's not important, completely understand. You're probably going to just essentially look at your different options, but I wanted to go ahead and give you on the front end, if this is super important to you, we're the only people. And we'd love to have a conversation. And what it does is it becomes a very clear filtering criteria and qualification criteria, because you'll actually have people that say no, but people that say yes are exponentially more likely to close faster.
Gotcha. You mentioned, you talked about content and you also talked about product pages, booking a demo and pricing as categories in terms of like intent data to look for, first party intent data to look for. Is there a... apart from the fact that like somebody looking at your pricing and demo page is perhaps like closer to actually taking that action, is there any sort of way you treat people differently based on whether or not they're just browsing, they're looking through like your guides, playbooks, watching like a webinar on your website, anything along those lines versus I'm like very close to buying?
Yes. I mean, we think through a lot of things in kind of the framing of an account progression. So an account goes through a variety of stages. So there would be first problem awareness. I'm going to be very clear. It's not company awareness. It's problem awareness. Like, do they know that the problem exists? Yes or no? Because I'm sure that we've all Googled something when we were aware of a problem. We looked at a company from a blog perspective. We got some semblance of an answer. And we bounced immediately. Like, but I don't remember the company that I looked at. I just remember getting the information because I was aware of the problem. So like, that's helpful. But like, I'm not going to ask somebody to buy off problem awareness. The next layer would then be initial engagement. So like, again, that might be a blog that is specific to the problem. Ideally, it's maybe something a little bit more meaningful. Maybe they've looked at the one blog. They then explored a couple other blogs. And again, I'm not saying even you do outbound on that from a sales perspective. I am just saying those are helpful things to look at and to see. And maybe you do some automated marketing follow-ups. Maybe you start an ad campaign based off of that. There's a variety of things that you can do. But at that point, that's still like very marketing heavy. It's not really sales involved. Then we get to meaningful engagement. So again, they know that you exist. They've done something. Meaningful engagement is you're starting to build trust. At this point, you may start to get some level of sales involvement with the goal being, again, we're now seeing a lot of engagement. They're exploring a bunch of stuff. Ideally, they're starting to look at some product pages and some pricing pages. And the goal here is how do we get them to say, I view you as a viable product and a viable solution, and we would like to have a conversation. And then the last piece to that from meaningful engagement into kind of the final stage before conversion is re-engagement. So again, they're showing a lot of engagement. They bounce. This is kind of that meaningful engagement would be product pricing pages. The re-engagement stage is how do we get them to go from product pricing schedule call page into something that is an actual conversion point. And once you've re-engaged, then you hit conversion stage, at which point now it's the sales pipeline. So again, all of those are different stages that you should think through. But like, I'm going to treat awareness and initial engagement radically different than I will meaningful engagement. Again, awareness and initial engagement, it might just be that we're following up with additional content with the goal of educating and showing, hey, we are a valuable solution in the space that you're trying to solve a problem for. But once we've gotten to meaningful engagement, which from my definition is like they're hitting product pages, they're hitting pricing pages, they're hitting schedule call pages, they've done interactive demos, they've like there, maybe it's, and again, this is nuanced to your business. Maybe it is a content pillar page that's super in depth and they like spent 10 minutes on page reading the whole thing. Again, that those are the nuances. I always lean towards product and pricing pages because everybody has those. And generally speaking, those are universally viewed as high intent pages. But again, if you're seeing, once somebody has read our content pillar page for 10 to 15 minutes, it shows that they are highly engaged and they have generally a clear awareness of the problem that they're trying to solve. And we see that the conversions off of that page are exponentially higher than conversions off of other pages. Maybe for you, that's meaningful engagement. So those are the nuances. But once you've hit that point, the goal is re-engage into a conversion. So that's how I think about it. And mapping those things out and then the actions that would follow based on the content and the engagement is incredibly beneficial as you look towards building a pilot program for your ABM programs.
Amazing. Mason, this has been a wonderful conversation. I learned a ton from this personally and really appreciate you having come on the show. How can people find you online or reach out to you if they want to think about kickstarting an ABM program at their company?
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned it a little bit earlier. So I spend probably way too much time on LinkedIn. So I'm there every day, sometimes multiple times a day. So if you are interested in learning more about account-based marketing or you really, really love super cute babies, my daughter is super adorable. I post photos of her. That's where you can find me, Mason Cosby, not Crosby. I'm not a famous football kicker. I can hope. But that is main place. Additionally, you can look up Scrappy ABM. So Scrappy ABM, there's a website. So scrappyabm.com. There's the podcast, Scrappy ABM. And then there's also the newsletter. So if you go to sendvox.com/scrappyABM, you can find the newsletter. I'm trying to think of anything else, but I think those are all the places. So podcast, website, newsletter, and LinkedIn are all the places you can find me.
Well, you know where to find Mason at this point in time. Mason, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having, for joining our show.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Scrappy ABM. If you enjoyed this week's episode, go ahead and give us a follow so that you don't miss a single episode. We drop every single Monday so that you can start your week off right. And if you're looking for additional great content just like this, go check out scrappyabm.com. We're building a library of frameworks, guides, templates, processes, and tools so you have everything that you need to build a low-budget, high-impact, scrappy program. Again, thank you for listening to this episode of Scrappy ABM. This has been your host, Mason Cosby, and we look forward to seeing you in the next one.